Good day, everyone. Dan Cassidy here, and welcome to UBS's How Should I Be Positioned podcast. So on this podcast, we do like to debate and discuss the factors at play that are driving market activity and how to position your portfolio accordingly. As always, we are joined by Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas, Jason Trejo from the UBS Chief Investment Office. Our special guest for this edition of How Should I Be Positioned is Rick Reeder of BlackRock. Rick is a Managing Director and is BlackRock's Chief Investment Officer of Global Fixed Income, as well as the head of BlackRock's Global Allocation Investment Team. I do want to point out as well that Rick is also a member of the UBS Research Advisory Board. And just for some quick context for our listeners, the UBS Research Advisory Board seeks to leverage partnerships to focus top thought leaders on the day's most critical questions and to share their differentiated guidance with UBS financial advisors and clients. So, Jason and Rick, it's great to be with you both today. I know there's a lot of focus right now spanning monetary and fiscal policy to market valuations to asset allocation, all that we want to cover during our time together today. So, looking forward to our conversation and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So perhaps we can begin with some macro commentary looking ahead a bit. Rick, how would you summarize your macro outlook for the balance of this year? And what do you think, Rick, is the biggest factor driving risk assets right now?
So, I mean, I talk about, you know, the broad macro outlook is driven by the extraordinary amount of stimulus that's gone into the system and, you know, assumption that you're going to get more, or certainly more on the fiscal side. We talk about that later. But then the amazing amount of monetary stimulus that's coming in. And I think people quite frankly underestimate the sheer impact of that monetary stimulus and the liquidity that puts into the system. And so if you said to me, you know, what will for fixed, you know, talking about fixed income assets, talk about equities and other assets, but this immense amount of monetary stimulus is, you know, when you buy, you know, $80 billion a month out of the, from the treasury market, $40 billion a month out of the mortgage market, and you simultaneously put this extraordinary amount of liquidity into people's hands, you know, a couple of stats that I've been working through for a presentation I'm doing. Numbers are truly mind blowing that if you take in 2007, you know, pre-crisis, it took 10, if you bought 10 trillion worth of fixed income, you'd make 500 billion of income. Today, it takes 24.5 trillion, so 2.5 times the size to generate half the income. At the same time, the demographic is in hyperspeed because, and the money that's gone into pensions and insurance. So, I mean, I just think you have to start every conversation about the macro outlook under the assumption that the world there's a dearth of income and there's not enough relative to the demographics. So everything that's driving, you know, our assumptions on where we're going to be for the rest of the year is under that we may have a pullback in economic conditions. And we've talked about this a bunch of times. I think the economy is in pretty resilient shape and, because of the stimulus, because of the monetary. And with that being the case, the employment situation is actually not going to improve as fast as the economy is coming back, meaning that you're going to have a Fed that's on hold for an extraordinarily long period of time, like nothing we've ever seen before. So, you know, if you believe the tail risk, the significant tail risks are out of the way, then, you know, our assumption has been from a macro point of view, gosh, get income into the portfolio in debt and equity space. And because there's not enough of it, and that's not going to change in the near term. It's not going to change in the near to the intermediate term.
Jason, what about your views in terms of where we are in the economic cycle, the U.S. today, where we might be headed, and the biggest factor driving risk assets at this point in time?
So I think Rick summarized it pretty well in terms of, you know, this has been a policy story, both monetary and fiscal, that's been driving the markets. You know, one thing that I kind of like to look at that kind of tells that story pretty well is actually interest rates in the U.S. If you take the 10-year treasury yield, it's around 60 basis points. It was down about 10 to 50, like about last week. But by and large, it's been kind of pretty steady at that level. But beneath that headline number is kind of a clear divergence between kind of real interest rates, which kind of matter for economic activity. Lower real interest rates, that's better for economic activity, and rising inflation expectations. And over the past month, we've seen, well, actually, if we go back into, let's say, June, real interest rates are down about 40 basis points, whereas inflation expectations are up about 40 basis points. And so at the headline number, it looks kind of relatively calm, but I think this is a big sort of churn that's going on in the market, reflective of the fact that, you know, the Fed and policy has been stimulative. It's expected to be very stimulative and accommodative for a long period of time, keeping interest rates low, but also positive for inflation expectations. So that's, if you look at what that is, its implications for equities, long duration kind of growth stocks, you know, tech stocks that benefit from future cash flows, from gold, from the dollar. I think that sort of interest rate dynamic that reflects policy has been sort of the key driver for markets overall. In terms of the economic outlook, it's, you know, the data in the U.S. is certainly moderated from the fast acceleration we saw a month or two ago. And there was concern that as the case count for the virus escalated, that we'd see a slowdown in growth. And it did a little bit. And now that that's kind of come down, even some of the more high frequency data showing things are starting to kind of pick up again a little bit. Just speaking at the point about resilience in the U.S. economy. So overall, still see the recovery taking hold, especially kind of globally, where there's probably a better situation overall with the virus right now, supported by fiscal and monetary policy, with some potential hiccups, but that's kind of the clear path going forward, at least for the rest of this year.
So monetary and fiscal policy, it seems to be a consistent theme, and I know we want to dive deeper into those items a bit further in the conversation, but Rick, I do want to get your pecking order in terms of the risks that could impact the recovery and perhaps trigger market volatility during this second half span.
I mean, it'd be hard to discount that, you know, the big one being that we get a significant second wave of the virus and that dulls the ability to reopen. You know, I have to say we have some pretty incredible people that help us with the science. And you know, our assumption is that the development, and I think markets today are continuing to react to it, the developments you're seeing are around vaccine therapy, et cetera, are pretty darn encouraging, particularly coming out of places like China. There's actually some real development in Japan and the UK, and then obviously in the US. So our assumption is that second wave, while not impossible or some form of mutation into, and to create some real concern is, while not impossible, we do think that the odds are moving very significantly towards, that continued reopening. And by the way, some of the data that you're seeing today on the manufacturing side, you're seeing this new order surveys in ISM, all the regionals, et cetera, are pretty encouraging, and that, you know, suggestive of that companies are willing to order. You're seeing some inventory build in some places that is encouraging as well. So, but that obviously has to be the biggest risk that we're faced with. You know, the other, you know, there's no wisdom to this around election, how people, whether they get concerned about, more concerned about tax policy and the dulling of the economy relative to that. You know, I think markets tend to overshoot on themes. And I think there's no doubt there will be some concern there. But I don't think that is going to be a dramatic risk, because I don't think a change in leadership, even in Congress, is going to create a significant desire to do something that would hurt the economy. And obviously the Chinese, the U.S.-China relationship is not going away, or the tension around that is not going away. And we see that through in places where we invest, in places where you have some pretty good data, whether it's through technology, military, et cetera. So I think that is going to be out there, and that's going to be with us well beyond the election. You know, if I said to you, you know, if you get asked all the time, you know, we run a lot of money, what keeps you up at night? I actually think that the thing that keeps me up at night more than anything else, while, you know, you have to follow the Chinese relationship, election, et cetera, is actually the volatility markets. And, you know, what happened in March and April, I think people underestimate that you lit a fuse on something that is really dangerous for markets. And I presented the Fed on this and talked about it, including the last guy 2 weeks ago. And what happens is when people short volatility, there's no income in the system, so people short volatility in a number of different expressions. And what it does is it drives volatility to the wrong price. And you see that manifest in the VIX, you see it in rate fall, you see it in currency fall. And then, but it's a straight derivative of of low interest rates. You see a lot of that that comes out of European investment that comes in different markets. I don't know why that, and you're, and by the way, you're seeing vols start to come down in all those markets again. It's got to be, I mean, it's one thing that, that does make me a bit nervous is that when you get more and more selling volatility or willingness to own illiquidity to hit your yield target, you know, that can create some instability in the system. And so when, you know, when we think about our portfolios and how we diversify and how we think about risks you're willing to take, you know, that's something I always put in the back of my mind is, and part of why when that vol drops, you want to get long vol into the portfolios. And, it's just something I keep an eye on quite a bit. And it doesn't, never gets talked about as a risk. Or I shouldn't say, generally isn't talking about, but it's one that I think from a market, as a market practitioner, is one that I think people underestimate the focus should be on.
Jason, what about your views in terms of risks or factors that perhaps keep you up at night?
So I kind of recovered two of the three that I'd written down. The first one was actually, you know, very near term is, you know, the fiscal situation. They're still negotiating or maybe not negotiating, unfortunately, in Congress and between Congress and the administration on a fiscal package. The presumption that we had in the markets that are had with the big deal passed, you know, potentially if not by the time they went on recess and shortly thereafter. Well, we're kind of at that deadline now and it doesn't look imminent. The next kind of hard deadline potentially is end of September when the budget year ends. So it's quite possible now that we may not get a significant package until the end of September, which means, you know, the various benefits that have been, you know, provided will expire. Other stimulative measures are going to go away temporarily. Even though there could be some catch up later on, that the 2 month period where you're not providing that support risks, you know, kind of really derailing the recovery to some extent. Not kind of completely, but yeah, I think it's in the near term, it's sort of an underappreciated risk. The other thing I kind of, you know, put down was thinking, you know, on the time horizon, you know, the election, at least adding volatility, but I think ultimately it's not kind of that disruptive. And Rick's point on the vaccine, you know, I think there's a kind of an assumption that we will have some sort of vaccine solution starting to kind of roll out at the beginning of next year. If for some reason that ends up being delayed, I think that's something that's perhaps not being, you know, fully anticipated. But it's actually kind of, as Rick was going through the kind of those topics, you know, kind of two questions kind of came to my mind. One on this point of the volatility, when I look at something like, you know, kind of credit spreads versus equity volatility, you know, there's capital structure models that try and sort of calibrate the two together. Credit spreads have certainly tightened quite a bit even over the past month. The VIX still over 20 is elevated from the fact that we consider we could be at an S&P at an all-time high. So do you think across different asset classes that these risks are being sort of priced more so in some asset classes more than others? And if so, where? And then also just given all these risks, do you think the market's sort of maybe not pricing in a sufficient public good at some of these things could happen? It's like, you know, again, with the S&P near an all-time high, you wonder why our is this a proper evaluation or is it, you know, kind of vulnerable to one of these things kind of materialize? And I'm kind of curious about how you sort of think about that right now.
So, I mean, I think, you know, with some of these markets, I still think that there are, I don't think that the S&P or I don't think the equity market is pricing in not pricing in risk today. I actually think valuations, I think valuations and equities are reasonable from a couple of different perspectives. One being when you take the discount rate, you know, exactly what Jason said, when you take the discount rate of these levels and keep it there for a long period of time, and you take the earnings yield and the free cash flow yield embedded in the equity market, that equities being, as you said, the longest rated asset, I mean, I think valuations should be higher than they are today, which, I think media likes to talk about is TINA. It is the fact that if you're running a pension or an individual that these valuations, you do look at the alternatives generate your return. So I don't think the markets are too high there. I think the bond markets are sort of starting to move to levels that, that will reflect that you may get some underpricing, but I don't think you're there yet in equity vol. Rate vol is not too rich at this point relative to the fact that, you know, the Fed's not doing anything in rates for a long time. The only place that I think that I'm a little surprised that the market is sanguine is the long end of the rates market of the U.S. Treasury market. And that actually is, I went through one of the big economists out there today. You know, if you assume that the trade that you're going to get more fiscal stimulus, if you assume that the Treasury is going to have to fund that, which is definitional, I'm pretty blown away. And we think inflation is going to move higher. We know they're dramatically higher. But boy, I am really surprised that the markets are willing to accept such low real rates. And as you get into the end of this year, the Treasury's already come out and recently came out, in fact, last week, and showed their hand in terms of how much more long end issuance they're gonna put into the system. I'm pretty amazed. Some of it is because you've seen international buying that's come in. Some of it you've seen, some model oriented buying into intermediate to long end Treasuries. That is the one place that I am surprised the markets are sanguine about today. Not that I think rates are going to move significantly higher. Not that if they didn't, if they moved much higher, the Fed would certainly increase their asset purchase program. But today they don't have to increase the asset purchase program because the market's doing it for them and letting, yields stay at these levels. But as you get into the end of the year, beginning of next year, people realize a lot of treasury debt has got to come to the market. So that is the one place by the way, we own long treasuries because they're a good hedge against other assets, but we've reduced the size significantly just because I'm pretty blown away by how aggressive the market's pricing long and real rates in that paradigm.
Yeah, it does seem as if the market presumes that they can control the entire yield curve, even if they do yield curve control, if it's at the front end. It's kind of just forgetting that, the back end can move for its own reasons. And if suddenly there's thoughts of inflation risk, then very quickly you price that in. So I would agree with you in that sense of probably underpriced, but we still like it again more from that kind of a hedge from an equity side.
Totally. Just going to say one thing to that end as well. I think the, munis have surprised me in their resilience. I mean, we own and we like owning munis in the portfolio, but ratios off of what is incredibly low real rates. Again, we still think it should be part of a balanced portfolio, like you were saying with regard to treasuries. But boy, they've performed really well. And they're, I would argue they're not cheap at these levels.
Just to revisit policy for a few moments. So Rick and Jason, as you both alluded to, there has been extraordinary amounts of monetary and fiscal policy implemented in the U.S. as well as elsewhere around the world in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Rick, what are the consequences, good and bad, that might emerge as a result of this policy mix?
So, I've actually started, my opinion has evolved a bit on this over the last month or so. And I have to say, first of all, I do think longer term, the pressure, you do create some pressure on the currency. And I do think there are limits to how much you issue in the way of debt, how much the Fed can grow their balance sheet. And, I think the markets have rightfully taken, taken up gold and have put some near-term pressure on the dollar. Again, I'm still surprised that the long end of the rates market seems to be in its own world relative to that. Listen, I think you'll get some inflation on the backside of this that will come over the next couple of years. But I have to say where my opinion has evolved a bit, and it's a broad call. I'm reading this book called The Deficit Myth. That's really fascinating. And I have not been a big fan of modern monetary theory, but I've definitely become more sympathetic to the view that we can run a larger deficit and we can run higher debt levels in the near to intermediate term, if you are creating positive economic growth and if the currency is, you show some modest depreciation of the currency, because I think there's two things that are happening that are incredibly beneficial to the U.S. economy. One being the dynamic around you don't create that much inflation. And inflation really is the big governor on your ability to do this. And so the pressure could put on rates. You're not going to run because the technological development and the way consumption changes has changed today that you actually won't create dramatically high levels of inflation. And maybe you don't even hit targets for a while. The second being the demographic evolution is so powerful today that you have a system that's actually now set up that can actually be a lender because of the structural dynamics around the demographics. So, the ability to put more debt on, particularly if the debt is not growing precipitously in other parts of the economy, like the financial system, like individuals who have actually functionally delevered, again, a bit going on in corporates, but not in a pernicious way. that actually think we can run a higher level of debt in the, and there's, there are limits to it. And I do think that longer term that, you know, they have to be very careful about, there's tremendous benefit of the U.S. economy from reserve currency status. And countries like China and Europe would, regions like Europe would, certainly like to see their currencies more actively utilized. And so that is definitely a risk. And, but I think the U.S. has room, from here. And I'm not that worried about we're pressing up against the limit today.
What about your thoughts there, Jason?
So, you know, one of the, probably the most common questions I hear from our advisors and clients is, given these large deficits, given how it's being financed with incredibly low interest rates, will this ultimately lead to either significant more inflation, sort of dollar debasement, potentially even some sort of financial crisis? And the risk gets kind of successively lower. Right now, we're probably more in a deflation shock given the dramatic decline in aggregate demand. The policy that's being undertaken now could be inflationary. I mean, you could say it is inflationary, but the question is, like, how far down the line does that potentially materialize? And what it is that actually isn't necessarily a bad problem. And I think, you know, having inflation, we get up to 3%, that's, you know, I think policymakers, you know, Jay Powell would never publicly admit it, but they would be very happy with that, because then you get nominal GDP growth around 5%, which means you can run even then sizable deficits and still start to get the debt, at least at a kind of a government level, start to under control. Also, in a short-term perspective, that, you know, the policy trap and the thing that we'd want to avoid, which I think policymakers have learned after the financial crisis over a decade ago, is that you want to avoid sort of a negative spiral where you have kind of both low inflation, low growth feeding up itself, and therefore you get to the low private sector investment or disincentives to invest in the private sector because of that environment, and it becomes hard to break out of it. So, you know, a comment I made earlier about how inflation expectations have been rising, that's actually, you know, I think a positive for the overall economic environment. So while there's certainly some risk longer term, I think that the policy response near term has been a reflection, certainly in the U.S., but even probably more so in Europe, where I think back in, was it 2010, the ECB president at the time, Trichet, raised interest rates, which in hindsight seems like an incredibly bad decision. And they also gave in fiscal austerity by kind of cutting fiscal spending. So exactly the opposite of, you know, what they're doing now. So I think near term, it's certainly a positive. Longer term, there are some risks. But if it also helps us kind of break out of a potentially kind of slower growth cycle, lower inflation cycle, ultimately hopefully, you know, the benefits of that would outweigh some of the potential risks.
The response to the pandemic seems to have triggered a policy paradigm shift, with monetary and fiscal policy now more closely linked. Rick, what kind of policy environment do you expect in a post-COVID-19 world?
I mean, let's start with the monetary policy side. I think you have to give this Federal Reserve an awful lot of credit. They've done, you know, it's so easy to be a critic. And I, you know, there were periods of time, like I think, go back, was it 4 or 5 years or so, I think the Fed kept rates too low for too long. And then, you know, I think Powell early in his tenure should have slowed down his tightening. But, you know, if you take the body of work this year, it's been really impressive. Big, flexible, early, and targeted, communicative in a consistent way. I don't know, I think they've done a great job. I think they're going to do more than less. I think they're going to increase the size. I think they're going to have to. We've modeled this up a million ways. I think they're going to have to do more on the asset purchase side. And I think they are willing to, I think they're very clear about the uncertainty is high, and we'd rather err on the side of being too easy, because I think one thing that people forget, the Fed has a multitude of tools to deal with inflation. It doesn't, as Jason said, it doesn't have many to deal with a deflationary dynamic that's hard on the level of debt that you have. So anyway, I think you're right in the stone that the Fed's going to continue to err on the side of being easy and easier. You know, I think the fiscal side is that, you know, you were getting into a big question about where we're going at the election. And, you know, I know talking to policymakers in the last week or so, there's a lot of politics involved. There is a lot of back and forth and horse trading, and we're going to walk away from the table, et cetera. But I think there is a resolute opinion that they need to go. And they need to do more around state and local. They need to do more around healthcare. There's a big discussion on corporate immunity for people coming back to work. And I think there's some legal discussion that needs to take place around what both sides are acceptable around. But listen, I think the fiscal is gonna keep moving. And then I think as we get into the next election cycle or post that, I do think infrastructure and spending on infrastructure is going to follow almost no matter who the president and the structure of Congress is.
What about your thoughts, Jason?
So something Rick had mentioned earlier about sort of MMT or modern monetary theory, kind of warming up to the idea a little bit. You know, we can debate whether that will actually happen or not, or if it's like, you know, not a name, but in practice, are we getting something along those lines where you get these huge fiscal packages that are effectively the Fed is standing ready to monetize it, if not, you know, through the markets, if not directly. So one of the changes throughout the last decade where it was kind of very much a monetary policy story, I think now it's clear that it's still monetary policy, but it's kind of a combined fiscal monetary, and if anything, fiscal is really going to be the key driver providing that ongoing kind of stimulus support. From a broad perspective, I think some of the, if you go back about 40 years when central banks were dealing at a time with, you know, high inflation, certainly in the U.S. when Paul Volcker was Fed chair, and fighting for central bank independence in order to kind of get that inflation under control, because Neapolitans always have some desire to probably allow inflation to run hot, because by the time it becomes a real problem, they might be out of office, and they don't want to undertake the pain of kind of tighter monetary policy. So we've seen a kind of basically a 40-year shift towards central banks trying to gain more independence, which makes sense in a world where you're trying to fight inflation, but now in a world where you're concerned about, you know, ongoing deflation risks, the idea of perhaps central bank independence becomes less relevant. So I think implicitly, I think we're sort of moving in that direction. The Fed, I think the expectations that they're at the September FOMC meeting will announce the result of a policy study in which they shift towards average inflation targeting. So basically having inflation at average 2% of the whole cycle, which means that if it's below for a period of time, you have to have inflation above 2% for a period of time. Again, that's kind of kicking a little bit more towards the path of tolerating a little bit more inflation, and again, consistent with, you know, allowing some larger, perhaps, fiscal deficits. So that's, I think, the big kind of policy change that will take place going forward. It certainly has some positives, like near term. The risk, I think, is longer term is that, you know, you hope that the fiscal investment is towards something that is actually productive. And I think the good outcome, if it's an infrastructure spending, something like that, that actually lifts productivity and long-term growth potential, ultimately that's a positive, and we kind of break out of potentially kind of the second stagnation we've been in for a while. The risk is that you just encourage malinvestment and you don't get productive investment, and you end up 5 or 10 years down the line with just bigger debt without kind of better growth potential. So it's certainly not without risks if you go down that path, because you're putting your faith not in central bankers, who I think, as Rick alluded to, have done a pretty good job, and you're putting your hands in politicians who have a different set of incentives that they operate under.
I know we're coming to the close of our time, and there is much more we can discuss, so perhaps that lends itself to some future follow-up conversations in the months ahead, but we do want to hit on some asset allocation before we close out our conversation for today, and Jason, perhaps we can provide our guest Rick with the final word, but Jason, can you walk us through your current views as it pertains to asset allocation at this time?
So we're still, I think, you know, fairly constructive on kind of risk assets overall. We have, you know, equities are sort of our most preferred, same thing with credit. I think, you know, Rick's kind of comments about sort of valuation thing is fairly spot on, that certainly on the equity side, if you take a long-term kind of relative view, equities don't look that rich, you know, despite kind of the evaluation metrics that by some historical standards like P multiple look a little bit expensive. So we still see upside in equities, you know, in the U.S., but also globally. You know, there's areas where, you know, there's a little kind of more priciness, obviously, in the tech space, but this is not 2000. You know, these are, you know, big companies that, you know, we saw in the second quarter still all growing earnings strongly. One area that we've sort of dipped our toe into trying to take a little more cyclical exposure is in mid-cap equities, which are, you know, companies that have market cap of, you know, 2 to 20 billion. So typically when you're coming out of a recession into recovery stage, it's these more economically sensitive companies, more cyclical, that do well. Not so much as small caps, where I think there's still a little bit of risk there, but that's one area where kind of bit by bit we're kind of dipping our toe into adding a more little cyclical exposure. And then on the credit side, I think it's kind of across the board. We still like, you know, much of corporate credit, you know, IG, high yield, parts of emerging market like sovereign dollar bonds. But I think, and now that perhaps spreads have tightened quite a bit, we're a little more kind of judicious in terms of adding some exposure and maybe starting to look at, do we want to shift that in that across different areas, given how well they've done just over the past few months. But overall, still, you know, kind of like risk assets at this point in time.
Okay, thank you, Jason. And Rick, your thoughts in terms of asset allocation?
I agree with Jason's thought on every one of it, actually. The only, and by the way, I mean, the way you described equity allocation, I couldn't agree more. You know, we, including today, have been doing some more in some of the cyclicals, you know, with this, with some greater comfortability around vaccine and again, being a bit judicious around small cap, but we like some of these cyclicals. And I would say one thing that we've been doing recently, I know we've been pretty public about, is for the first time in I don't know how many years that we're taking some more risk in Europe because of the Eurozone Recovery Fund, fiscal stimulus, less reliance on negative interest rates, which I don't think work. And there are just, you know, problems. It's just hard finding a lot of names in Europe that are vibrant, good growing companies. So, but you know, there are some. You know, I'd say there's 25 or so we like. And so we've been doing a bit more there. You know, Jason Saad, I mean, credit has done really well. We, you know, we like credit. We still like credit. As Jason said, some of the high quality, not just in credit, but also in some of the securitized market, muni market, has gotten pretty full. And so we've been rotating some of that. And, that would just bring some notional exposure down our portfolios. And, but we're comfortable with a good deal of the high yield market. And wading a bit more into parts of EM where you're getting paid for taking some upside risk. We're still pretty moderate in EM, but taking a little bit more risk there is if you believe the dollar is going to stay moderate here and global economic growth is going to be better shape. I mean, China's growth has been impressive, so we're wading a little bit more into EM. Alongside of that, but that's the only, and as Jason described, you know, in a balanced portfolio, having some gold and, you know, even today, tips and you know, break evens have rallied, but we still think they're a good part of the portfolio. And so we continue to run along there, in the inflation space. And our duration exposure, as we talked about, you know, I think the whole front end of the belly of the yield curve is a waste of time. Yeah, other than just holding more cash and then some in the back end, despite that the fact that the back end is cheap, it does actually have some value to you from a broad portfolio balance point of view. I'll leave it there.
Well, Rick and Jason, really appreciate your time and insight and for joining us on the How Should I Be Positioned podcast today. I know there was much more that we could have covered, but really appreciate all of the ground that you did cover with our listeners. And as I alluded to earlier, perhaps we can have a follow-up conversation in the months to come. But again, great catching up with you both, and thank you again for joining us today.
You're welcome, Dan. Take care.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And again, we have been joined by Jason Dreho, the head of asset allocation for the Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office, as well as Rick Reeder from BlackRock. Again, Rick is a managing director and BlackRock's Chief Investment Officer of Global Fixed Income. Rick is also the head of BlackRock's Global Allocation Investment Team and is a member of the UBS Research Advisory Board. And this, again, has been another installment of UBS's How Should I Be Positioned podcast. Again, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.